topic is, if I remember correctly, are you tired of that little voice inside you saying, who do you think you are? So before we go into the question of who do you think you are and how to respond to that little voice, let's go back a little bit in our history to get a little bit of a sense of who we are as a people. Just what is a Jew, in order to get a greater insight into who and what we are as individuals. The first Jew we know was Abraham. And Abraham acquired a title in his lifetime. He became called Abraham the Ivri. And the word Ivri, our sages tell us, comes from the Hebrew word Aver, which means the other side. And our sages tell us that the entire world was on one side, and Abraham was on the other side. At that time, the entire world was under the rule of Nimrod, who instituted pagan rites and idol worship. And Abraham was alone, individual struggling against an entire world. And he became known as Ivri, the one who's on the other side. The whole world is on one side, Abraham is on the other side. The entire world is pursuing paganism, idol worship, self-indulgence, and Abraham is preaching monotheism, the service of one God. And he put his life on the line for this. He was thrown into a burning furnace in which he spent 3 days. The trees grew there in the burning furnace so he should have fruit. And miraculously, the entire world saw how God came to his rescue for standing up to the entire world. However, and this process, the Jewish people were set apart from other nations throughout their travels until they came to Egypt. Egypt is the first time where we start seeing the process of assimilation. The first time Jews started adopting the customs the descendants of Abraham had kept separate, and they were also known as Ivri. As it says, when Joseph was identified to Pharaoh, Pharaoh was told that he's an Ivri. That he's from that family, that unique separate family which is separate from the entire world. But once the Jews settled into Egypt and they lived amongst the Egyptians, they started adopting some of the customs of the Egyptians. And yet our sages tell us, and in fact they fell into idol worship and paganism. But our sages tell us there were three things that they still kept, that kept them distinct from their environment. The Jews kept their names. They had distinct names, their Hebrew, their Jewish names. They dressed different. They kept their old original dress, the way they had dressed before they came to Egypt. And there are different opinions as to what the third thing is. They didn't change their eating habits. They kept kosher. They ate differently than the rest of the Egyptian world. So the Jews kept themselves separate and distinct, even though they had already become completely assimilated. But there were these few things that separated them. And then there came the redemption from Egypt. The Jews are taken out, and they brought to Mount Sinai, and they're given the Torah. And once again, here they're set apart from the entire world. Our sages tell us, why was this mountain called Sinai? Because it's connected to the Hebrew word sinah, which means hatred. When the Torah came down to the world for the Jewish people, our sages tell us hatred came down to the world. Because all the nations of the world at that time began to hate the Jewish people. And our sages tell us, just as a father were to separate one son from amongst the rest of his children, and single out one child from amongst the rest of his children, it's inevitable that the other children are going to resent that. That's inevitable. That's built in. If you single out one individual child, there's going to be that resentment. There's nothing you can do about it. It's part of the process. And that's exactly what happened. When God singled out the Jewish people at Sinai, after the Jewish people had already singled themselves out and distinguished themselves, our sages tell us hatred came down into the world. The Jew was separate and distinct from the rest of the world and hated for it. And we continued on our travels to the Holy Land, which we conquered and settled in. But again, slowly the assimilation process began. And we were supposed to kick out all of the nations that were present in the Holy Land, but it was supposed to be done in a gradual process, because if you empty out a land in one shot, it'll be overtaken by wild animals, it'll become deserted. So they were supposed to gradually chase out the nations that were present. And what happened was, at some point they stopped, and they allowed to continue living amongst the Jews people from other countries, from other nations. And again, the assimilation began. And the Jewish people started reverting again to paganism, to idol worship, to the pursuit of self-indulgence. And this began the beginning of the end, and the Jews were kept being warned by the prophets, and ultimately the Jews were sent into exile. It's the middle of this exile, again, the Jews are pariahs, they're sent into exile, they were separate and distinct from all the other peoples, because everyone knew who is a Jew. And so at this period of time, after they were exiled, after the destruction of the first temple, and in this period of exile, where the story of Purim takes place. And again, what happens to the story of Purim? Even though the people, after the destruction of the temple and the exile, the people began to repent because they recognized the folly of their ways. And once again, what happened? The years went on, and they settled into their host countries, and they became comfortable, and they became prosperous, and they started doing very well. And they started becoming assimilated again. And in fact, it says that when the king at that time, the Persian king Ahasuerus, made a great festive party, which lasted many days, and our sages tell us that this party was celebrating the fact that, according to his reckoning, the 70 years had passed since the destruction of the temple. And the Jews had been promised by the prophets that after 70 years, they would return to the Holy Land and the second temple would be built. So according to his reckoning, the 70 years had ended. And he was celebrating this. And the leaders of the Jewish people at the time told everyone was invited, everyone in the capital city was invited, and the leaders of the Jewish people at the time begged the Jewish people, don't participate. This is not a party for you. This is celebrating your own downfall. They're celebrating the fact that our temple was destroyed, and according to him, he thinks that that the 7 years have passed, and therefore it'll never be rebuilt. And yet the Jews, it was a party, everyone was attending. They didn't want to be left out. They didn't want to be different than everybody else. And once again, the Jews, trying to assimilate and trying to belong, attended this party. And in fact, he in order to make sure that everyone felt comfortable, he saw to it that there was kosher food so that the Jews shouldn't feel uncomfortable there. And that's it. The Jews came and they participated. This is the backdrop for the story of Purim. When along came the king's wicked minister, Haman, and at least we know who's who. So this wicked descendant of Amalek, the classical enemy of the Jewish people throughout history, comes up with a plot to destroy the entire Jewish people. But he describes in the plot that he wants to kill a specific type of Jew. The word that appears in the Megillah describing the Jew that Haman wants to kill are called Yehudim. In all of the scripture, the word until that point, the Jews are referred to as Ivri. The first time we see the appearance of the word Yehudi, which is the basis actually of the word Jew, is a derivative of the word Yehudi, Jude, which became Jew. The first time the word Yehudi appears is in the Megillah, is in the story of Korah. And it was those kind of Jews that Haman wanted to kill. So our sages tell us, what is a Yehudi? What is this new description for the Jewish people? What is a Yehudi? Our sages tell us that Yehudi is somebody that denies, that stands up to false gods, that stands up to idol worship. Because the old Ivri Jew, had already become assimilated. Sure, he kept his customs and he kept kosher, but he still felt comfortable being amongst, assimilating amongst his surroundings and trying to blend into his environment. A new type of Jew grew out in this period called the Yehudi. Mordechai's title is called, who's the hero of the story of Purim, is called the Yehudi. He's the Yehudi because when Haman had a decree passed that everyone has to bow to him, the only individual who would not bow was Mordechai. The Yehudi, the Jew, does not bow even to the most powerful forces in the world and stands up to false beliefs and false gods. So our sages tell us that if the Jews would have converted at the time and accepted these false beliefs, the Jews would have rejected their Jewishness, they would not have been included in the decree. Because the decree was specific only towards not Jews, not Ephraim, but Yehuda. Only a Jew that's going to stand up for his Judaism and face the rest of the world. That is the only kind of Jew that was included in this decree, which was all Jews. Unless a Jew would give up, reject his Jewishness, and give it up, then such a Jew would be saved. What was the response of the Jewish people? When this decree came out, the word came out, it's over. On this and this day, this and this time, all Jews are going to be wiped out. What was the response of the Jewish people? The response of the Jewish people was that even those people who had begun to assimilate, even those people who had tried to blend into their environment, stood up and proclaimed their Jewishness. The decree came out 11 months before the date of annihilation, the date that had been set aside. And for the entire 11 months, every single Jew stood up and proclaimed his Jewishness in public. Every single Jew alive at that time, not one Jew broke ranks to save his own skin. In fact, our sages tell us that this display of Jewishness was so powerful, was so awesome, that many of the Gentiles at that time wanted to convert, even though it meant a death sentence. All Jews are going to be killed. The fact they saw this tremendous power, this tremendous faith, this tremendous depth of connectedness to their God and His Torah, that every single Jew, man, woman, and child, is willing to stand up and put their life on the line. Not one Jew broke ranks. And that was something that was so powerful and so awesome that many people converted at that time. And it was in the merit of this tremendous self-sacrifice that the decree was not actually annulled. The decree was never annulled. It was turned around. That Ahasuerus said, when the whole story played out and Esther came and got him to agree to change the decree, but he said, I can't undo an existing decree. What I could do is put out a new decree which says that the Jews are entitled to fight back. That was all he did. He didn't annul the decree, and yet the entire world was stood down by a relatively small group of people by a tiny fraction of the world's population stood down the mightiest armies of the entire world, who were under Ahasuerus' rule at the time, and they all backed down in the face of not of this tremendous military might of this small group, but the tremendous show of faith, the tremendous show of commitment, of connectedness to God and the Torah, to everything that Jews have lived and died for so many generations, that everybody just, the opposition just folded. No one could stand in the face of it. So what's going on here? What are the dynamics here? And again, we see throughout history, this keeps going on. The Jewish people try to start drifting away and start assimilating. And in more recent generations, Jewish people try to adopt every single ism that came up through in the last two centuries. Were top heavy with Jews, communism and socialism and every ism that you could think of was, the leadership was all Jews. In fact, in Hitler's Germany, he used to say that the Jews are the capitalists and the Jews are the communists. So everyone says, what do you mean? How could it be either that a communist or that a capitalist? But the truth is, it was both. The capitalist world was disproportionately represented by the Jewish people, and the communist world was disproportionately represented by the Jewish people. Wherever there was some ism that offered somehow the Jew the opportunity to blend in, to assimilate, to become part of his surroundings, a tremendous amount of Jews fell into this new theory, this new philosophy, this new approach. And in fact, it's in the last two centuries that we went from a people that the overwhelming majority of people were observant to a people in which a relatively small minority are fully observant. That's how powerful these isms have been in our own time. So what is this dynamic that's pulling the Jew on the one hand? On the one hand, the Jew has in him this thing that sets him apart from everybody else. And in times of difficulty, in times of difficulty, we find that Jews stand up for their Jewishness. Even in the most recent history, we found in the Six-Day War and in the Yom Kippur War and in the Gulf War, people who didn't identify as Jews for many years, somehow, when they felt that the Jewish people were threatened, their Jewish consciousness came up, their identity came out, they felt that somehow they have to identify as a Jew. Many, unfortunately, don't know how, don't know in what ways, but there's some surge, there's some awakening of Jewishness, there's something that sets a Jew apart. As much as we try to be like everybody else. In fact, I once saw an old Time magazine from the 1920s, so this is before the days of civil rights, and Hollywood was referred to as Jewtown in the magazine. That was how it was called. Hollywood, New York is Hackneytown, and Hollywood is Jewtown. And the fact is that wherever we go, we stand apart. We're set aside. Even when we try to join the culture, and we try to throw ourselves into the culture, and be like everybody else, we're set apart. So what is this pull? The pull, the attraction to be like everybody else, and at the same time, to be different, to be set aside, to stand apart. When we talk about that little voice that's inside everybody, that says, who do you think you are? If we look at each individual in their own lives, we discover an amazing thing. When we look around us, and the world is waking up to this in a very big way, which is why the mental health community is growing. Even in times of recession, when the medical schools and the law schools slow down, the schools producing mental health professionals are booming. It's a growing industry. Because what happens is people have come to the realization that very often, we're not who we think we are. There's somehow, we have ideas of who we are, but somehow there's something in us that's telling us our idea of who we think we are is wrong, and we have to find out who we really are. Who am I? Why is that? Be- Because most of the ideas that we get, what we call a self-image, what the world calls a self-image, where does a self-image come from? A child is not born with a self-image. A self-image comes from the people around us. The messages that we get from the people around us is how we build an image of ourselves. Sometimes messages real or perceived. Sometimes we imagine that so-and-so thinks such and such of us, and that influences how we think of ourselves. So we learn from especially our parents, our teachers, our peers. We develop an idea, an image of who we are based on the feedback that we get from the people around us. And that's how we build a self-image. And in fact, when we look around, we see so many people whose self-image is ridiculously incorrect. You can meet a person who's brilliant, and they think that they're stupid. Why? Because they had a parent that always told them, you're stupid. Whenever the child said something that the parent didn't approve of, the parent said, you're stupid. How can you say such stupid things all the time? So you have a person who's objectively brilliant by any standard of scoring intelligence. The person's brilliant. And he's thoroughly convinced. 1,000%, he's thoroughly convinced that he's stupid. So where did he get that from? He got that from the fact that he has, that the person, the people in his life who are closest to him, who have the most impact on him emotionally, the people who he's closest to, who mean the most to him, whether in a positive or a negative way, that person or those people gave them messages about themselves that they come to believe and accept. You have people, and this incorrect belief system in who I am, this incorrect self-image, could reach to the point of self-destruction. There are people who are convinced that they're no good. There's something wrong with them. They're flawed. They're just no good. You speak to, I deal with, I'm involved in outreach with teenagers, many who are into the heavy metal and drug scene, and a very high percentage of them, almost all of them I would say, are convinced that they're no good, they're bad, and therefore they relate tremendously to the lyrics of anger, of self-destruction, of suicide, of the expressing unfettered emotion, but the basest and lowest of human emotion. They relate to this because they think of themselves that way. Either they got that message from parents, or they got that message from their school experience, from their peers, and they're thoroughly convinced that they're bad. They put on a tremendous front of saying, I don't care what anybody says, I do what I want. They put on a tremendous front of thinking that they're as good or better than anyone else. When you get a little closer to them, you see that they're thoroughly convinced that there's something wrong with them. They're bad. And some of these kids, I look at them, they're so sweet and innocent. They're just putting on this show, this act of being this tough, angry, bitter human being. And really, and you look at them, you can see that it's just a show. It's just something that they picked up from somebody else. But they're carrying it around, and it's destroying them. It's destroying their lives. There are people who are thoroughly convinced that they're overweight, like I am, thoroughly convinced of that, and they're not. They're not. In fact, they're underweight. And yet, they look in the mirror, and they're thoroughly convinced that the mirror is not showing them that they're overweight. The way they imagine that they are being perceived through other people's eyes is that they're overweight, that they're flawed. There's something wrong with them. And they latch on to overweight, and they kill themselves. They call it anorexia. They starve themselves to death because there's something wrong with the way they appear. There's nothing they could do. They're thoroughly convinced that there's nothing they could do to be good enough in other people's eyes. So what happens is, this whole concept of a self-image, this whole idea of a self-image, what we carry around with us, if we would sit down and figure out where we picked this idea about ourselves up, you could trace it back. Usually it's very logical. You could trace it back to a parent, to a peer, to a school experience, to something that we experienced as a young child, and either we read it right or we read it wrong. But either way, the way we read it stuck with us, and that's who we think we are. And therefore, even when we try to rise above some of those negative messages that we picked up, there's always that little voice inside saying, whether it's your mother's voice, or your father's voice, or your teacher's voice, or your friend's voice, there's a voice inside saying, who do you think you are? Who do you think you are? You know that you're not going to make it. You know that you're no good. You know that you're a loser. You know that you're a failure. Who do you think you are? And yet somehow we know instinctively that this is wrong. We know that something is wrong with our image of ourselves. We know that it's off. It's not accurate. It's not correct. So what do? Today, everybody, we're all looking for movements, which I can explain to us. Who we are. So this one is into psychology, and that one is into self-help, and this one is into doing your child work, and this one is into, everyone is looking for something. This one is into Eastern meditation. Everyone is looking for something. How to somehow either go back and fix it at the source in the past, or somehow pick up some new way of thinking, of living, and getting beyond what they call in the self-help world rewriting your scripts, or they call in the psychology world overcoming your neuroses. And everyone has their own language for it, everyone has their own approach for it, and this is what everyone's busy with. And there's no sign that the more busy people are with it, the better off they are. There doesn't seem to be, the evidence doesn't seem to be that people are doing that much better. If anything, it's an industry that seems to feed on itself. My father's actually a practicing psychologist. And he told me that he was once at a conference where the presenters at the conference were some of the biggest people in the field. And he went over to each one of them and he asked them, he wanted to know how to gauge how he's doing. So he went over and he asked each one of them, what's your success rate? So the first thing that each one said is, how do you define success? So he said, success means that person, a well-adjusted, self-reliant, self-sufficient individual who can carry on their life. So they all said, there's no such thing. You mean without therapy? Someone who's self-sufficient to be able to carry on their life without therapy? There's no such thing. My father was naive. He thought that the purpose of therapy was that people should ultimately grow beyond it and be able to function on their own, which is how he had been operating all the years. He had a lot of people walking around on their own doing quite well. But he met these people, these super successful people, and these top names, and they told him there's no such concept in psychology that someone who could now go live their life on their own. So my father started calling himself, when he would meet people and they would ask him what type of psychology he's into, he would introduce himself as a results-oriented psychologist. And people would just, that's a very interesting approach, results-oriented. But he practices in the field of results-oriented psychology. But the fact is that everybody's looking for the answers to these questions. And nobody knows where to look. And people have moments of self-discovery, and people have moments of insight. And are people who, for these few moments, every one of these fields offers you something. It's not that they're offering you nothing. Otherwise, they couldn't keep up the illusion. They've offered you something. So there's people, I met people in meditation, who spent 18 years in meditation. The only thing they did, they were blissful. The only thing is they didn't function as human beings. They didn't have families, they didn't have jobs, they didn't have lives, they didn't have anything. They were just blissful. But they didn't do anything. So they were busy being blissful, and then nothing else was happening. And some of these people, when they finally left TM and tried to live normal lives, they have no idea how to cope. Absolutely no idea how to function. They have to learn from scratch. So people are willing to, in order to discover themselves, their inner selves, their inner child, their inner something, everyone knows there's something inside me. There's some inner something that we have to get to. And no one knows what it is. So everybody's grasping at straws. Or else just living lives of quiet desperation, hanging in there. But the fact is that there is a blueprint. The Jewish people have an exact descriptive blueprint for who and what we are. We have something that describes to us who we are and what we are to the most minute detail. And that's called the Torah. The Torah lets us know exactly who we are and what we are. Superficially, what the Torah appears to be is a collection of laws. In fact, there are 613 basic laws, basic commandments, and each one of those basic commandments has countless corollary laws. And a person could spend their entire lifetime studying these laws. And many people do. And it's a tremendously challenging pursuit to study in depth and understand these laws, and it's a work of a lifetime, and it can never be completed. The depth and intricacies of these. But at the same time, there's a deeper level to this Torah, which shows us that the number 613 is also mirrored in our very souls. Our souls have these 613 components. And these 613 components in our soul correspond to these 613 commandments. On the surface, it's a legal system. But if you look a little deeper, what it is the key to the Jewish soul. The non-Jew has seven laws, seven commandments. That is, the Stone Seven Commandments, when studied on a deeper level, provide the key to the human soul. The Jewish soul is something very different. And it has 613 components, and every one of these components has a corresponding commandment to that component. For what? We're supposed to develop, we're supposed to bring out, we're supposed to dig deep into ourselves and bring out that which is our innermost core, our innermost essence. The key to that is these commandments. What is our core? What is a Jew? What is that deepest innermost essence that sets a Jew apart? That deepest innermost essence that sets a Jew apart is the fact that the Jewish soul is literally a part of God himself. It says that God breathed a soul into man. That breath, that soul that is breathed into man, into Adam, our sages tell us that when God chose the Jewish people from amongst the nations, he reserved that distinction of Adam, that description, that aspect of Adam, which is that his soul is the breath of God himself, is reserved for the Jewish people. Every other human being also has a soul. That's a human soul. And a human soul serves its function and its purpose. The Jewish soul is different. The Jewish soul is the breath of God. It is a direct emanation from God himself. But it says that he blew it into this earthen, that God, when he created Adam, he created this earthen form, and he breathed life into it. He breathed the soul into it. The problem is that that earthen form serves to conceal the true nature of the Jewish soul. The earthen form is no different between a Jew and a non-Jew. That so the body looks exactly the same. There's no difference, superficially. You would, same body. What's different is the soul. Now, Jews also have a human soul. Besides for a Jewish soul, a Jew also has a human soul. What are the things that the nature of, it is the nature of the human soul to pursue? The nature of the human soul is to try to do those things that serve me. Everything in creation has in it the instinct of self-preservation, the natural instinct to look out for number one. Everything that exists, the whole animal life, the most powerful instinct is the instinct of self-preservation, of self. And so too the human being, with his human soul, has the exact same instinct. The instinct of self-preservation, to look out for yourself. In fact, there was a period where there was a whole genre of self-help books on the theme of how to be a selfish pig. Because that's what people wanted, are really interested in. Sure, sometimes you have to present it in more sophisticated forms. There are more sophisticated people that are not comfortable with the idea that they're basically self-serving and concerned for themselves and looking out for themselves and want to indulge themselves. But that is the most natural instinct of the human soul, is self-indulgence. Some do it in more gross and grubby ways of self-indulgence, and some in more sophisticated, even spiritual ways. But the basic, the center of the human experience is basically self. So when I grow up, when I come into the world, the way I see, I see myself as the center of my universe. And as I grow, there is the one who provides me food and love and care. I start realizing there's other people out there besides myself. There's a mother, there's a father, hopefully. And as my world expands around me, I see that there's siblings, that there's other people, there's an outside world. And as I go, my world expands, my universe expands. But I'm at the center of my universe. Me, my life is about me. It's not about you. You have your life, and that's about you. I have my life, and my life is about me. I am the center of my life. And who am I? Who am I has to do with how I interact with the people around me, how the people around me relate to me, gives me an idea of who I am. But the Jewish soul is different. The Jewish soul has God as the center of its existence. God as the center of the universe. And sees itself as peripheral to God's existence. So it sees the whole world from an entirely different perspective. Abraham, the first Jew, said, God is the center of existence. And I'm willing to die for that. If my existence is canceled out, that's irrelevant. That's not important. That's not significant. So what? The main thing is that the truth be told, that the truth be revealed, that God is the center of all existence. When God is the center of all existence, then I'm ready to sacrifice myself in order to support God's existence. Not to in any way, God forbid, contradict that truth or that reality. So when a Jew finds himself at a time and there's a decree that says all Yehuda, all those who deny idol worship, are going to be killed. So what does the Jewish soul do instinctively? It stands up and it says, I'm a Jew. If it's Killing Jews Day, count me in. I'm Jewish. Kill me too, because I'm a Yehudi. What do you mean, kill me too? You got nothing better to do with your life. You got killed. The answer is, my life is only of significance if God is the center of all existence. A life in which I live my life where I am the center of my own existence. That's a meaningless, for a Jew, that's not a life. So what happens is like this. When we sit And we let the world, we look at the world around us, tries to tell us who we are and what we are. And we get messages from our parents, and we get messages from our friends and our teachers and our peers and the world around us. The media is blasting us with messages constantly. Who we are, what we are. Every day some new pop psychologist comes out with a whole new idea and everybody's excited. I have an aunt whose sister was married to one of these guys who made his living by going on television and saying everything's all right. That was it. In the 70s, there came a new thing, the television psychologist. And he saw a way to make a killing. He was a psychiatrist. He saw a way to make a good living. So what did he do? He got on every television show saying, adultery, sure, that's fine. As long as it feels good, that's fine. Adultery is fine. Divorce is fine. Breaking up families is fine. So, whatever you wanted, anything that was popular, anything that people wanted to do, any area of self-indulgence, he got up and gave a whole psychological explanation of why it's fine. And that was it. He made a lot of money doing it. The people loved to hear that. Why not? It's fun. So we get all kinds of messages from, we're being bombarded on all sides. And one of the worst messages that we get, especially as Jews, is that the problem with the Jewish people is that they're ethnocentric. Like that's like that's this word that like, oh, that's terrible. I'm not ethnocentric. God is. Me as a human being, as a person, I have no interest in being different than anybody else. I just want to have a good time. I just want to party. I just want to live it up. As a human being, my human side, hey, let's have a ball. Life's a blast. You only live once. But my Jewish side tells me that God is the center of all existence. That God is the center of all reality. I'm not ethnocentric. I don't want to be different. But being that God is the center of reality, and God set me aside, then I have no choice but to be whatever He made me to be. So just like the tree will never be a frog, and the frog will never be an elephant. No matter, they could want it, they could sign petitions, they could create a whole philosophy why frogs ought to be trees and trees ought, but it won't work. The way God set it up is what they're going to be. And that's the way it's going to stay. I have a Jewish soul not because I decided to have it, because God gave me one. And that Jewish soul, which allows me to tap in to the divine reality, which is a world in which God is the center of its existence. And that is something that I have, and I didn't do anything to earn it. There's countless stories in our history. Every religion has its martyrs, its saints. In Judaism, the entire nation has been martyred and sainted time and again. It's not something for unique spiritual individuals. It's something that the entire people have done time and again. When called to it, Jews have martyred themselves, have put their lives on the line. Even Jews who had no Jewish education and almost no Jewish background. They were not spiritual beings. There are countless stories of Jews who were not spiritual beings. They were just regular Jews. And some of them were lowlifes. I remember reading an account of the head of the Jewish mafia in Krakow. At the beginning of World War II, when the Germans rolled into Poland, so they were looking, there were two things they were looking for. They were looking for rabbis, and they were looking for wealthy people or criminals, the people who had the money. So they rounded up the Jewish mafia. And this guy was the head of the mafia. He had lots and lots of money. And they rounded up in a synagogue a bunch of the Jewish scholars, and they were all waiting to find out what's going to happen with them. And they bring this mafia, this fellow Max, who's the head of the Jewish mafia. Now, they took a Torah scroll and they rolled it out on the floor and they told Max, spit on this scroll. Now Max was a kid who grew up without any Jewish education. And his response was the following. He said, I never kept one word that it says in the scroll. Anything that it says in there, don't do, I did it. And anything that it says in there, do, I never did. He says, but if you want me to spit on it, you can kill me first. What? He says himself. It's meaningless to me. It has no impact on my life. It's a piece of parchment with some ink, letters inked on it. It has nothing to do with Max's life. And yet he says, kill me first. And there are countless stories like this. This is just an example of an individual whose life is the exact opposite of a martyr, of a saint, of somebody who lived an exemplary spiritual life. He's a lowlife, a murderer, a criminal. Kill me first. Because the true nature of the Jewish identity is that the only true reality is God's reality. Everything else in creation conceals that truth. Everything else in creation proclaims, I exist. I am. Look at me. I exist for myself. The only thing in creation that proclaims to the world anything different is the Jew. The Jew says, I exist for God. And you want to know something? You all also exist for God. Except you don't know it yet. But one day you're going to realize it. You know what that day is that you're going to realize it? When Mashiach comes. The time of the redemption. What we're waiting for is the day, as it says, all flesh shall see that the word of God, that the mouth of God has spoken. What does it mean, all flesh shall see that the mouth of God has spoken? Because creation in the Torah is described as God's verbalization. When God spoke, let there be light. And God spoke, let there be oceans. Whatever it is, let the waters gather and there should be oceans. Let the land grow. God spoke. It says, we know, we believe.